I'm one of your international speakers. I've come all the way from New Zealand, which is just a little bit closer than Perth, I think. So, you know, I'm as international as you get, I think. I work for a company called Datacom. I'm a solutions architect for them. I've been doing a lot of work with Azure over the last little while. So, I'm going to talk about my session, working title, getting Foxy with Azure Infrastructure as a Service. The alternative title I had was Azure, what does the Fox say? But we've gone with the other one though, so we're good. So look, what I want to talk about today really is about Azure and how to get more out of it as an IT pro. So can I get a show of hands out there? Who's actually used Azure? A few of you. And any developers in the audience? Just cool, because I make fun of you guys, just so you know. This is really about IT pros getting more out of Azure, but hope the devs might learn something as well. So I guess there'll be a short test on this slide at the end, so just make sure you've committed everything to memory. You'll need to know at least 20 different Azure services. This slide is basically say Azure's a really, really big platform, and it does lots and lots of things. And even this is out of date, in fact. So this is from April, and I can already count things that Microsoft have added. So Azure Search, Document DB, automation. They're adding services all the time. So Azure's a really big, really big platform. And as an IT pro, it's kind of hard to get your head around the fact that there's all this, there's all these bits and pieces. Then, and which bits do I use, and which bits are useful to me as an IT pro? So that's kind of what I'm going to try and talk about today. So because I guess IT pros, we kind of familiar with virtual machines. You know, we all know what a virtual machine is. We can kind of deal with that. But when it comes to, what is a service bus and why would I need one? So let's just have a think about some of the things we're going to, we'll see in Azure and how we can make better use of Azure. But first, what I want to talk about is about 10 minutes talking about some of the basics of Azure. So just getting the basics right, level setting for us. So the first thing with Azure, choose the right VM type. So you've got options now with Azure around these things called basic and standard VMs. So if you're using a standard Azure web service, you're running two VMs and they're load balanced, well then using standard VMs. But if you want to do something that doesn't need the load balancer or needs kind of, doesn't need all the features of Azure, you can use this thing called a basic VM. And basic VMs are cheaper than standard VMs by about 30%. And they also, don't have things like the load balancer in place. So it means you can optimize your cost differently. If you want to do, say, something, I don't care about availability, or I'm doing availability in a different way, I can use a basic VM rather than a standard VM. The caveat to that is, though, that they do have less I/O per disk. So they get 300 IOPS per disk rather than 500. So you do have to kind of balance that up. So it's a cost and availability question there. Microsoft also kindly, just before I finish my slides, announced a new set of VMs. I think it was last week they announced them. So they've now announced these D-series VMs. So all the existing VMs, they're all those your standard T-shirt size VMs, A0 to A14, I think, these days. They've announced this new series of VMs called D-series VMs. And the difference between A-series and D-series is that D-series VMs have got faster CPU, so they're up to 60% faster in terms of CPU. But they've also got a local SSD temporary drive. So, when you spin up an Azure VM, you get a temporary drive, which is your D drive. On your A-series VM, that's standard SAS disk, probably. On your D-series VMs, that's a local SSD. So if you need to do something that involves writing a lot of temporary files and you need fast access to it, then the D-series VMs add that support. So you've got a D drive, which starts at about 3,000 IOPS. On the smallest D-series, and they go up to about, I think it's 48,000 IOPS for the largest VMs. So, things you can use that for, SQL's TempDB, if you need to, SQL buffer pool extensions, or any other local temporary cache stuff you might need to do. If you're writing a lot of cache, then write to the D drive. So these new D-series VMs are now available. Next, manage your availability. So when you're in Azure, you've got to manage availability. Microsoft don't manage availability for you. Their SLA is 99.95% if you've got two VMs in an availability set. If you've got one VM, what's your availability? What's your SLA? You don't have one. They'll try and keep it up, but there's no guarantees. If they need to take, you know, a host down for patching, your VM goes down and your service goes down. So you need to manage the availability, and either you manage it using availability sets or you manage it some other way, you know, build your own or whatever it happens to be. So use the load balancer for any incoming internet traffic. Azure, you know, you're running standard VMs, Azure provides the ability to configure a load balancer. Earlier on this year, they also added support for an internal load balancer. So if you've got internal only traffic, say SQL always on, ADFS, those kinds of things that need a front end service to access them on a, you know, single IP address, then now you can use the internal load balancer as well. So it's something else that's available there. And use a separate availability set for each tier. So if you've got a standard web app, you know, running IIS front end, SQL back end, don't put them all in a single availability set. So, you know, you might end up with, hey, I've got two IIS, two SQL, I've got them sitting in one availability set. Microsoft could theoretically take down, you know, your two IIS VMs and leave your two SQL VMs running. So use a separate availability set for IIS, a separate availability set for SQL. So manage your availability carefully. Use the VM agent. So when you're installing virtual machines, the VM agent's a software component that Microsoft provides. It's available, you know, when you're building machines through the UI, it's turned on by default, and it gives you a bunch of different extensions that allow you to do stuff to VMs. And some of the useful things are, you know, the most obvious one is BG Info. All the VMs have BG Info installed. When you run up a VM, you'll get that nice screen, shows you what you're doing. But there's a couple of other good things there. VM access is a really good one. So if you've spun up a VM and you've forgotten what the admin password is, you can use the VM access extension to go in and reset the admin password, provided you remember what the admin username is. If you've forgotten that, you're really out of luck. That's available. It also lets you fix up the RDP settings remotely. So if you think RDP's gotten corrupted for some reason, you can use the VM access settings from PowerShell and run that up and fix up the RDP settings. There's some Azure Diagnostics that you can now do, some logging things that's only available through the new portal. And there's a custom script extension. And we'll come back and have a look at a PowerShell extension in a little while. Use virtual networks if you need them. So you might need them, you might not. If you're building a standalone app that's just going to sit up in Azure, it doesn't need any connectivity to your on-premises network, it doesn't need to talk to kind of anything else but itself, then you might not need a virtual network. But you know, if you do have to do something like a hybrid connection through to an on-premises app, or you want to manage it through your standard management tools, you've got a bunch of different cloud services that need to talk to each other directly. You want to isolate stuff a little bit better than you can normally. You want to bring your own IPs or IP ranges, or you want to use VPN like ExpressRoute, which we'll talk about in a while. Then that's when you need to use virtual networks. So you do, you know, they are useful. They're there. Use them if you need them. Use PowerShell. So use the Azure PowerShell commandlets. You download these from the web platform installer. Try and do as much as you can through PowerShell. And in fact, there are certain things you can only do through PowerShell. So you can only configure the internal load balancer through PowerShell. You can only reset your VM password with the VM access extension through PowerShell. So it does expose more functionality than the portal UI actually exposes. So it is important. If you're on one of those other operating systems, then there are cross-platform command line tools you can use. So if you're an OS X user, then use those command line tools. That's what they're there for. So let's just have a quick look at the basics. So a couple of things. First up, new VMs. I'll just quickly show you a couple of things here. We'll just go R2 data center. You've got the option of basic and standard. So we talked about this. So if you want to get lower price, then use your basic VMs. There's also now these D series VMs in there. So you'll notice they're slightly different sizes than the A series, but so all the D series are there as well. And those are the ones with the fast local SSD cache. So they're all there. It's just give a username and password. I just want to quickly show you the infect to do this. Fine, and our VM agent. So, VM agent. That's the little piece of software there. So it's you can see it's checked by default. I would suggest leave it on. There's not really a good reason to not leave it on unless you've got particular security concerns or whatever. Otherwise, just leave it on. It's there by default. It lets you do useful stuff. So leave it there. You'll also see now there's actually support for doing things like if you want to use Puppet or Chef to do configuration management of your VMs. That's kind of built into Azure as well, and also some security extensions as well, which is kind of handy. If you want to pre-install a bunch of things, pre-install Microsoft anti-malware or Symantec or whatever. So that's handy. The next bit is availability sets. So I've got a couple of VMs here, these two demo VMs here, but they're currently running in a single cloud service, which I've got running here. And there we go, they're both running in that single cloud service there, but they're not an availability set. So if one of those VMs should fail, or if they need to do maintenance, there's no guarantee that my service is going to keep running. They are basically treated as individual entities. So on my VM, I can actually just come in and create a new availability set for it and save that. It will tell me it's going to reboot the VM when it saves. Yep. So it'll say it's going to reboot. And so it'll go off and it'll add that machine to an availability set. And so now I can add a second machine in. And so when Microsoft go to do patching, they will make sure that one of those machines is always running all the time. So then you're managing the they're managing the availability for you based on what you've defined for it. So that's as easy as it is to do availability sets. And that's kind of really all I wanted to show you for the basics. So we can actually get on to looking at something more interesting. Cool. Good. So, how do I get more out of Azure? So, hey, we can run some VMs, we can do some availability, we can do some load balancing, we can do all those kinds of things. That's great. How do I get more out of it? How do I leverage some of the power of the platform to do things better? Because that's really, I can do a whole bunch of things the way I used to do it, and I can move my legacy stuff to Azure, and I can manage it and run it exactly the same way I used to run it. But fundamentally, have I made things any better? I might have reduced my cost, which is good, but have I made things better or easier for myself? And my theory is, if you're using one of these public clouds, it should be about making things better, easier, faster, more reliable. And if you're not getting that, then you're not getting the full benefit of the platform. So how do you get more? First thing, automate everything. So where you can, automate something. So don't just go to the portal and run up VMs like I just did. Automate it with PowerShell or with the command line tools. So there are a couple of different automation bits and pieces in Azure. So obviously the first thing is PowerShell. The second thing is Azure automation. So Azure actually has an automation platform built into it, and we'll talk about that in a second. And also this PowerShell desired state config agent, which we'll also talk about in a second. So what Azure automation is a platform that Microsoft provides inside Azure. It allows you to, anyone familiar with System Center Orchestrator? Yeah. A few of you? Yeah. So what Azure Automation does is it brings automation-like capabilities, kind of what you'd expect in System Center Orchestrator. It's PowerShell only though, so it's not, there's no UI, no nice UI for dragging and dropping PowerShell. But you build runbooks in Azure, you store them in Azure, and then Microsoft provides you an engine that actually goes off and executes those runbooks for you, and you can do that on, you can do that with a schedule, you can do that manually, so you can use these runbooks, and you can do all sorts of things. But you could start and stop VMs on a schedule. I'm a developer, I run a test environment for my developers, and they only work, 8 to 5 if I'm lucky. That means my VMs are running, they're running for 16 hours a day where they're not being used. So and I've been charged by the minute for them, so why don't I shut them down for that 16 hours and then start them up, you know, when the developers come in. So I could automate that process using Azure Automation, have those VMs start up every morning, 8 o'clock, shut down at 5 o'clock, my bill gets reduced, you know, automatically I'm paying two-thirds less than what I would ordinarily be paying. So it's a great way to, you know, to get a bit of extra value out. You know, you could do things like patching, you could do things like spinning up new environments automatically. There's all sorts of things. And so, and because it's PowerShell, I can import my own modules, bring my own modules, be they third party, be they Microsoft ones, that allow me to integrate into other systems as well. So if I need to talk to other things, I can use Azure Automation to do that. So Azure Automation is a great thing. And one of the really cool things about this is that it aligns really, really closely with the on-premises story with a bit of functionality inside System Center Orchestrator called Service Management Automation, which is exposed through Windows Azure Pack, and it provides basically exactly the same experience on premises. So you can kind of get a lot of synergy between what you do on premises and what you can do in the cloud as well. So that's Azure Automation. I'll show you a quick demo of that in a second. The other bit is this PowerShell DSC agent. So does everyone know what PowerShell Desired State Config is? Few of you. So PowerShell Desired State Config is a really cool bit of functionality that Microsoft shipped, I think, in version 4 of PowerShell. And what it lets you do is, if you're familiar with using tools like Chef or Puppet, it's a configuration management tool, and it allows you to set a desired state for a VM. So I want it to have these Windows features enabled. I want it to have these registry keys in place, these files in place. I want this service state to be started. I want this service state to be stopped. Those kinds of things. So I can set up a desired configuration for a VM or a group of VMs or whatever it happens to be. And then I can apply that to those VMs. And PowerShell will make sure that VM is in the state that you define. And then I can reapply that setting if I need to change it, or I can reapply it if I need to confirm that things are there, or if I need to make a change to my VMs, I can just update the configuration, reapply it, and it will go out and do that for me. So PowerShell Desired State Config is a way of configuring Windows VMs, and in fact, they've also shipped a preview of the Linux Desired State Config agent as well. So now you can configure Linux VMs with PowerShell, which kind of blows my mind. So the Desired State Config lets us do that, and set the state of a virtual machine, which is great. What Azure have done is take that and then say, well, actually, we want to use those things to configure up new VMs that we spin up in Azure. So now you can take a desired state config file, you can store it in Azure Storage, and then when you run up the VM, you can tell it to look at a particular desired state config configuration and apply it, and that VM will pick up that configuration as it's provisioned, or I can then, you know, same thing, if I want to update that configuration and reapply it to a VM, I can do that as well. So really great bit of functionality, and it saves you, you know, logging onto a VM and once you've configured it and installing all these features and doing that stuff. It does, you know, it takes all the hard work out of doing stuff for you. You might just have to log in and, you know, do any final customization you might want to do that you couldn't do through PowerShell or whatever. Or there might be content you need to copy from somewhere into it. But basically, automate as much as you can with this with DSC. I'll give you a demo of this shortly, in fact. The one thing about it is that it's only configurable through PowerShell. You can't do it via the portal. So again, PowerShell, I don't know if you're getting a theme here, PowerShell. So, demo. So, first we'll have a look at PowerShell Desired State Config. So, I'll just zoom that in. So, what I've got here is a nice little PowerShell Desired State Config file. It's about as simple as it can get. I didn't want to complicate things. I've got a configuration called IIS install. It applies to a node called localhost. So basically, whatever machine I run this on, it'll apply to. But I could do, I could do particular VM names. I could even put roles in there. So I could say role web server and make it a role-based thing and do that. But this case, it's real simple. Apply it to whatever machine I run it on, localhost. And it's got one configuration which says the web server feature must be present. pretty simple. So that's what a desired state config file looks like. I'm not going to get into a lot of detail about that, but that's what it looks like. So with that file now, we can take that, we can publish that file into Azure Storage. And in fact, I'll just quickly run up Azure Storage Explorer. So I'll just show you, I've got an Azure Storage account here, and you can see that it's empty. It's got this Windows dash PowerShell dash DSC container inside storage. And so what this is going to do is, I've got this script here, which is basically, all it's going to do is publish a configuration, and it's going to publish it into the current storage account, and it's going to publish that that particular configuration I was just looking at, that melbourne.ps1 configuration. So all I've got to do is run the PowerShell command, publish Azure DSC configuration, and the configuration path I want to publish, and it'll throw it into Azure Storage for me. So if I just hit play, that should go and do that, and everyone will be happy. Hopefully. And in the meantime, we can have a nice awkward silence, because that's my favorite bit of presentations. Wakey wakey. Normally this is reasonably quick. Let's have a look and see if it's... Oh yeah, there we go. So you can see now in that container there, I've got this melbourne.ps1 and it zipped it up for me. So it's now a compressed file sitting inside Azure Storage, and it's ready for me to use. So what I've also got is a script to create a VM for me, and the one important line is just here, set Azure DSC extension, and I'll tell it which configuration I'm going to use. I'm going to use melbourne.ps1.zip, and which configuration out of that zip file am I going to apply. So I'm going to use the IIS install. So what I'm going to do is when I spin this VM up, it will end up applying that config, it will run up, it will have the web server component installed, it'll be running a stock standard Windows Server 2012 R2 with IIS installed. And I won't have to do anything apart from run this script, so I won't have to log on and do anything. So what I'm going to do is run that up, and we'll come back to that VM a bit later on, because this will take 10 minutes and we can't really kill that much time with me wittering on. So while we're waiting for that, we'll have a look at Azure Automation. So Azure Automation is still a preview feature, so it's only available, I think, in East US at the moment. So it's still a preview feature. What we do is we end up creating an Azure Automation account once you've signed up for the preview. And in your account, you've got Azure Runbooks. So I've just got two in here, start and stop dev VMs, pretty straightforward. And if I go and have a look at this one, let's just have a quick closer look. There's actually a bunch of stuff in there around managing how I actually access my resources. So I've stored a bunch of variables inside Azure Automation. I've stored my subscription name, I've stored my ID, I've stored a public key for a certificate in there as well, or a certificate with a public key on it, so that I can manage my subscription using a certificate. And then all I do is that last line of code is the only bit that actually really does any work, which is start Azure VM, and that's a standard Azure PowerShell commandlet. Start Azure VM, the name of the VM, and the name of the cloud service, and they're just variables that I pass into that runbook. So it's just a standard bit of PowerShell. It just happens to use PowerShell workflow, and Azure's automating it for me. And so I can author that offline using the PowerShell ISE and then publish it up to Azure, or I can, in fact, come in here and make changes in here and edit it online and see it's got nice little syntax highlighting and all that stuff. So away we go. So, but the other cool thing is of course, I can test it. Now, when I say test, as usual, with anything automation related, testing is a bad way to describe it. It actually does what it's going to do. All I'm doing is making sure that my script runs, but it actually is going to do, you know, if it says delete 20 VMs, it'll delete 20 VMs. So just be careful. And so all I do is I can go test and go yes, and it will prompt me in a second for a service name. So that was those variables that we had in there, and I will use those, and that'll go off and it'll start the runbook. It takes a while to actually have any activity happening on it, so I'll just quickly shoot up to this VM here. This small VM01, you can see it's currently stopped, so it will start up in a sec. It takes a couple of minutes. So while we're waiting, let's have a look at a couple of the other bits and pieces of automation. So we had that start VM, we've got that start VM runbook. So that's I ran that manually. You know, I started up manually. It's going to go off and do its thing. But actually, I want to do this on an automated basis. And so in the scheduling tab, I've actually got it linked to a particular schedule, which, and you can see it runs every morning at 9 o'clock, East US time, I guess. So now I've got this thing, it's gonna run every day, 9 o'clock, that VM's gonna start up for me. And I've got a corresponding one in the stop VM one, which runs about 20 minutes later and stops the VMs. So I'm only getting charged for the time that the VMs are running. I'm not getting charged otherwise. So I'm saving myself money, and these guys are just starting up and stopping by themselves. So I can schedule this stuff. And the other thing I can do is come back here. Is I've got these assets, and so assets let me store things like variables, schedules, you know. So if I've got my subscription name is just a variable, and I can reference that in any of my scripts that I want to run. I can just get a reference to that particular item. So I can store variables. You can see I've got a couple of schedules there. If I need to import my own PowerShell modules, I can do that down here with this import module. So I've got a bunch of flexibility about what I can do with it with Azure Automation. So it's pretty powerful. And again, you know, as it's PowerShell, you're basically limited by your imagination. So there you go. And let's just quickly check that VM. It hasn't actually kicked off yet, so hopefully that'll eventually happen. Like I say, the some of the automation takes a while. Someone can take a while to actually start. So hopefully that will come up in a bit, and hopefully that's going to run too. So let's just refresh that. In fact, I'll have a drink. Any questions while I wait? Stunned silence, everyone too hungover to answer. Not enough morning coffee. Right. Well, we'll come back to that in a second. Anyway, we're going to use the VMs that we created with the with that PowerShell script. We're going to use those VMs in a later demo. So hopefully they all worked. All right. So that's automation. Next thing, think multi-data center. So Azure's got data centers all over the world, and apparently there might even be some here soon, you know. So Azure's got these data centers all over the world, and you're not limited to just running your stuff in one of them. You can run it in as many or as few as you like. So think about ways you might start to leverage that. So there are a couple of different ways you can do that. One of them is VNet to VNet routing. So I can create virtual networks in, say, East US, I can create virtual networks in Southeast Asia. Those virtual networks are completely isolated and independent from each other. With VNet to VNet routing, I can actually connect those two networks together and have those function as a fully routed network. So what we used to have to do was basically connect those networks up through our corporate network and route them back down to our corporate network, back out again, and to another Azure data center. Now we can do VNet to VNet routing. It allows us to treat those two VNets as basically a routed network. So now I've got a routed connection across Microsoft's backbone. So it doesn't cross the internet, it crosses Microsoft's backbone. So now I could say, hey, I've got a resource running in Southeast Asia, I've got a resource running in West US. They can talk to each other, and that's fine. You know, there's some things you have to think about. Obviously, your VNets can't have overlapping IP ranges. They've got to be unique IP ranges. but you can, they can be different Azure subscriptions, they can be different customers. You know, you could have completely different Azure customers and they could do VNet to VNet routing. So if you want to do partnerships or whatever with people and connect, you know, particular bits of network infrastructure together in Azure, totally doable. One of the scenarios that enables this is cross-region SQL always on. So you could have SQL always on running in you know, one location and another instance running another location and have those replicating across two different VNets, and now you've got failover between data centers. So if there's a full disaster in West US and everything falls over, then you can just fail over to an instance running somewhere else in a completely separate region, but your data will be in sync as much as possible with SQL always on. So there are some cool things you can do with that around keeping different things in sync. You might have line of business applications that need to be able to replicate. So you'll be able to do that now with VNet to VNet routing rather than having to come back through your corporate network. Another way to think about multi-data center is a bit of functionality called Traffic Manager. So Traffic Manager is effectively, you can think of it as DNS with a bit of policy wrapped around it. And so what it does is it allows you to set up a DNS record for your website. Hey, maybe it's www.yourapp.com. And it allows you to say, this endpoint routes to three different instances running in three different data centers. And I can use a few different algorithms to determine where traffic goes. So one of them, I can use performance. So I can say, well, take me to, when someone requests access to that site, send them to the closest instance. And it does that based on network latency. So, you'll make a request and, if we're sitting here and the Melbourne data center finally opens, then hopefully we'll get redirected to the Melbourne data center. If we go to the US, we'll get routed to a US location. So it'll do that for us. We could just do round robin. So just take me to the next, just go through each instance as we go. Or I could do a failover. So I, might have an active passive kind of scenario where I go, always route me to this data center, unless that fails, in which case go off somewhere else. And so that's what Traffic Manager does. Basically, the way you set it up is you set up a namespace inside Azure Traffic Manager. So it'd be, contoso.trafficmanager.net. You'd create a CNAME for your www record and point it at that endpoint. And then Traffic Manager does the endpoint monitoring for you and says, is that endpoint healthy? Is it alive? Is it accepting requests? And it will forward requests based on whatever policy you've defined. And actually, so you can do it in cloud services, so things running in virtual machines or on the platform as a service stuff. You can do it across Azure websites, and so you might have something like, you might have your primary service running a whole bunch of virtual machines, but then you might have an Azure website running, because it's cheaper, just running a maintenance page or something, or a failure page or something, so that if your primary website's gone down, you can just redirect everyone, to the website version, which just says, sorry, we're doing maintenance or whatever we're doing. And actually now you can use non-Azure endpoints as well, so you can force it off to on-premises stuff as well. So if you needed to do that, you can. So that's what Traffic Manager does. So what I thought I'd quickly do is just show you how easy it is, in fact, to set up. Cool. So I've got Traffic Manager here. I've got an endpoint called Datacom Cloud. So you can see over here, it's datacomcloud.trafficmanager.net. So that's what my that's what I'm going to set my CNAME up to point to. That's my DNS name for my Traffic Manager endpoint. And you can also see that it's inactive at the moment. There's no endpoints configured for it. So from a configuration point of view, all I have to do now is come in and add some endpoints. So I created a couple of VMs just before using PowerShell desired state config with IIS running. And this is where the demo could all go horribly wrong. This is what we like. So all I have to do is add some endpoints, and the cool thing is that any endpoint obviously doesn't mean any because there's none. I'm going to use cloud service, and so you can see I created these ones here, these TEAUSF, so this one and this one, they're the two I created with my Azure with my PowerShell using my desired state config. So all I have to do is add those endpoints into Traffic Manager, and now Traffic Manager will start load, but will start balancing load across those two endpoints for me based on whatever policy I've got configured. So I've got a policy over here. Let's have a look. So so at the moment, my load balancing method is performance. But I can obviously change that to round robin, or I could change that to failover. And if I go failover, it will say, you know, I can say which ones, what priority I fail over between. So it's kind of super easy to configure. And the other thing is, how do I validate that my endpoints are actually up and running? And so I've got some monitoring settings here. So I've got the option of HTTP or HTTPS protocol monitoring, and so I can use whatever port I like, and I can use whatever, you know, if I've got a particular status page that I want it to check or whatever, then I can put that in there. But at the moment, it's just doing a standard check of the route and seeing if it gets a 200 response back, and away it goes. So with any luck, come back here, it's still checking endpoints. So let's see if it actually works yet. So I'm just going to paste that URL in. And within luck, oh yes, it works. So I've got, so my machine's been configured with PowerShell desired state config running a web server. I've now stuck it behind Traffic Manager. I don't know which instance I've ended up going to, but I've gone to the one that's closest to me, hopefully. So my desired state config stuff worked, which is great. And Traffic Manager is now redirecting everything there as well. So that's how easy it is to set up Traffic Manager and get traffic going to, you know, individual endpoints. And everything worked, which is great. So, any questions there? Yeah. Yeah, so the question is that with the load balancing algorithm, is it based on just latency, or is there load on the server? At the moment, it's just latency, as I understand it. Not there's kind of no there's no digging down into the server to say, you know, what is this thing doing and how much load it's taking. It's just latency based. So it'll take me to the closest one. Cool. Next. Leverage Azure Storage. So Azure Storage is one of my favorite bits of Azure, and one that, you know, it's a great bit of functionality. You know, you write your data into Azure Storage. Azure stores it in three different locations, if you know, and that's transparent to you, and that's done at a kind of a price point that is really, really hard to beat with any on-premises storage infrastructure. So, you know, I don't know, it's 3 or 4 cents a gig for three copies of your data to be stored in a single data center. And then if I want to replicate it to a second data center, well, I can do geo-redundant storage in Azure Storage, and I can get, you know, six copies of my data stored in two different data centers, and I'm doing that for kind of 5 cents a gig. So the economics of Azure Storage is pretty amazing. So the things you can do with it are great, except that I'm an IT pro, and Azure Storage is access with this thing called a REST API, and basically I'm an IT pro, the only thing I really know about resting is what I'm going to go and do after this, you know, and I don't know anything about how to make a REST call using my storage. You know, I've got SANs, and I've got things that I understand, that, you know, fiber channel and block storage, and you know, I understand that kind of stuff, but I don't understand REST and how I make an application talk to a REST API, or, you know, or an OS talk to REST API. So how do I do that? There's also, actually, this thing's, I'm accessing it over a WAN, so it's actually, you know, it's fast-ish, but, you know, it's not like I'm running on local block storage, right? And I've got to manage the cost of that WAN as well, so I can't just say, well, I've just opened a bigger pipe because that costs me. So, you know, I've got to manage that. And actually, I want to store data in there, but actually, I'm kind of a bit worried after I heard about Edward Snowden and the NSA snooping on everything. Do I, you know, is my data going to be secure up there? So, could someone just come and look at it and do what they want with it? So, so Microsoft have kind of solved that with their Store Simple appliance, and I really like it because it allows us as IT pros to use things that we are familiar with. So it provides an iSCSI interface to a bunch of you know, VMs or OSs or whatever they happen to be, to talk using a protocol that we know and understand. I understand iSCSI, I understand how it works, and it does the translation between iSCSI and then taking that data and moving it using REST API calls to Azure Storage. So I understand that, and it makes sense to me. So now I can put an Azure StorSimple device on premises, and I can have, you know, have my stuff talk to it in a protocol that works as IT Pros, and it will deal with storing stuff in Azure for me, which is great. Except I don't want everything stored in Azure. I want the stuff that that I use frequently. I want that stuff stored locally. And so that's where StorSimple's also got some charts. So it says if the data's hot, I'll store it locally on the device. If the data hasn't been accessed for ages or I'm running out of space, I'll fire it up to the cloud. So that's cool. I've just solved a problem with archive, you know. I've worked with customers who've got terabytes and terabytes of data that they're scared to do anything with because they've had it for 20 years or 10 years or whatever it happens to be, and they've got piles of it and they don't ever delete anything because I might need it. But they've got to store it somewhere, and every time they store it, they've got to provision local SAN storage for that. They've got to provision backup capacity for that. They've got to do they've got a long-term plan for that. They can't kind of deal with the fact that they have to manage the storage. So this is a great way for them to just say, well, actually, I'll keep the stuff that's actually being used on premises. Everything else can get stored off in the cloud and I don't have to deal with it again. If I need to retrieve it, it'll come back from the cloud when I need it. It'll be great. Also, but then I go, well, do I have to back that up? Well, actually you don't really, because with StorSimple now I can actually just take a cloud, what they call a cloud snapshot. So I can take a snapshot of this thing. I can have a local snapshot, cloud snapshot. I can have a local snapshot on the device for quick recovery. I can do, that's my dailies. I can do long-term retention into the cloud, and I can store that at a, you know, like I say, 5 cents a gig. That's cheaper than buying tapes. That's cheaper than buying disk-to-disk storage. So I get a bunch of benefits there as well. So I take out a whole bunch of cost out of my business around storage, around backup, around management of data, around archive, and I replace that all with a single device that makes sense to me. So that's kind of why, that's one way we can leverage cloud storage as IT pros. You know, it's using something we understand. And so that's what I like. I'll just skip this bit. Another way we could leverage Azure storage is using Azure Files. So what Azure Files does is it provides a SMB interface, again, something I understand, server name / share name, I understand that, I'm an IT pro. It provides an SMB share that exposes Azure storage. So I can write to it using protocols that Windows servers work with and that I understand, but it writes it into Azure storage. And what this is it's only exposed inside Azure, so I can't use this as my file share for my on-premises people. I can only use it for VMs and stuff running inside Azure. But what it lets me do is, hey, if I've got VMs that need to do, you know, if I've got shared config or I've got a diagnostic share or whatever that I need to store data on, I don't have to spin up a separate file server to do that. I can just spin up an Azure Files share and have everything write to that. It means that I can pick up applications that might have been a bit tricky to do or might have needed to, you know, oh, I've got this file share dependency. I can just leave the file share dependency alone and bring that up with me. So Azure Files is another great way to interact with Azure Storage. And it's kind of reasonably new. It's come out in the last kind of 6 months or so. Next, use the VM depot. So looked at the Azure portal before, saw a bunch of VMs in there. They were, you know, there's Windows images in there. That's a bit of a surprise. There's a bunch of Linux images in there. There's Oracle VM images in there, but actually there are other images out there that you can run on Azure. So VM Depot is basically it's a community catalog of VM images. So you know it might be, hey, I want to run up a specific LAMP stack, or I want to run, for instance, I want to run a Barracuda load balancer or a Kemp load balancer, and I want to run that without having to pre-configure it. I can go to the VM Depot and spin that stuff up. They're all available there, and I've got access to do that. I can get through it through the new portal, it's fully integrated, or I can get to it via the images tab in the existing portal. And so I'll quickly show you that. It's, you know, just so you know that it's there. Where am I going? So virtual machines, images. And if I go browse VM Depot, Might take a second. I've got gazillions of images that I can run up here. You know, I talked about that Kemp Loadmaster and provided my, you know, so if I run a Kemp load balancer inside Azure, I can come in here and provision it straight out from the VM depot. So rather than having to, and you know, you might have other random requirements like, you know, JRuby stack or whatever it happens to be, or something called Guacamole, then cool, there's a whole bunch of stuff already built for you in the VM depot. So don't necessarily worry about you know, building stuff yourself if you don't have to. Have a look in the VM depot, see if stuff's there. Back. So another thing is to think outside the box. So, oh, I didn't change. Six. Cool. So another thing, think outside the box. So Azure provides a bunch of constraints. So, you know, so one of them is that the load balancer behaves in a certain way. So, you know, the Azure load balancer is you know, it does active-active load balancing. It doesn't do active-passive. You might have a requirement to do active-passive. So don't think to yourself that's the only way to do things. You know, when you're looking at how to use stuff in Azure, think about things differently. Use a different solution if you can. Build your own if you need to. You know, if it's the load balancer, then use a Kemp. Build a Linux one running HAProxy. I don't know, whatever it happens to be. But don't necessarily be constrained by the basics. Just think that there are other ways to solve things. Just because you're running in Azure doesn't mean you can't solve. You have to solve them the Microsoft way. You can solve them in different ways. So, you know, and leverage the VM Depot where you can to do that. So just, you know, like I say, just think outside the box. Think of different ways to achieve things if you need to. Now, I'm going to invite Thomas up from Equinix because I want him to talk about ExpressRoute. So Master's going to do 5 minutes for us on ExpressRoute.
Thank you, Stu. Good morning. I'm Thomas Horvath. I'm a global solution architect at Equinix Australia. Equinix is a global data center, and we're basically the ExpressRoute provider for Microsoft Azure around the globe in 16 markets. And we will be launching the service in Australia as well when the Azure data centers go live. So what is ExpressRoute? Stu talked about Azure in general and networking. Normally, you access a cloud service through the public internet, like in the demos, we're accessing the portal through the public internet. And you might be concerned that your data is not secure accessing the internet. ExpressRoute gives you a way to have a secure private connection to Azure. From your on-premise data center, if you're using a hybrid scenario or for any data transfer. What's the benefit of that? Much better performance. So first of all, it's important to know that when you access Azure through public internet, there's a limitation for the bandwidth. It's 80 meg per sec. You can use IPsec tunnels or SSL tunneling to secure that line through the public internet, but that's going to just add some overhead on that 80 meg per sec. So if you really need higher throughput, ExpressRoute will give you that connectivity. And on the other hand, if you really want to make sure that it's secure, you can go out, have your telco provider have a private connectivity through an MPLS network to the Equinix data center. It will be launching in Sydney initially when ExpressRoute is coming, when Azure is coming live, and Microsoft is planning to have another ExpressRoute connection later on in Melbourne as well. So as you can see, the Azure data center has the compute and storage capability. It's sitting in a separate data center. It's not at Equinix. Microsoft runs fiber to our data center at Equinix. It's in Sydney in an SY2 data center. That's where the Microsoft Edge routers are. So at the launch of Azure, that will be the single point in the whole of Australia to connect to Azure as a secure private gateway. So the benefit and the reason why Microsoft chose Equinix, we don't provide the carrier services, long-haul telco services. carrier neutral data center. That means that in Australia, we have all the carriers connected to our data center. So when you want to have a connection, you don't need your telco to lay down fiber. There's over 120 telco and carrier service providers already connected to a data center. It's basically all the domestic and international carriers. So whoever your incumbent telco provider is, they will be connected, so you can access the data center through their long-haul network. I put lower cost there because there's a charge for Express Route. Microsoft has different plans. You can look up the pricing. The US pricing is up on the Microsoft website. There's certain egress traffic included. With Express Route, anything that you put into the cloud, which Microsoft calls ingress, it depends how you look at that, that goes into the cloud, is free. Traffic coming out of the cloud will be charged. With Express Route, there's certain free egress traffic included. And after a certain volume, you will be charged. It's the same with public internet access. If you have data coming out of the cloud, that there's an egress traffic cost. Express Route egress charges are actually lower than public internet. So it's just a consideration that if you have an application or Azure service pumping out a lot of data out of Azure, then Express Route might be a lower cost option for that egress traffic. So how does it work technically? What we provide is layer two connectivity. So you connect to your data center through fiber. It's an Ethernet connection. It terminates in our data center. And we have a switching fabric, which we call the Cloud Exchange. We provide this kind of direct private connectivity to multiple cloud providers. In fact, we have almost 200 cloud and managed service providers in the Sydney data center. The layer two connectivity will then connect to Microsoft Edge routers. And as you can see, this is a really enterprise solution because Microsoft mandates two redundant connections. The reason for that is there's an SLA for this connection. That's three nines, 99.9% SLA. And that's why you have to have the redundant physical ports and virtual ports as well. On top of the layer two connection, you can see that you have to establish a BGP session. It's actually two BGP sessions. I will talk about that. Now, BGP, you might not be familiar with that. BGP stands for Border Gateway Protocol. It's used in internet routing, so it's mainly the telcos and network providers using that. With cloud, you need to get familiar with BGP because most cloud providers use that protocol. The two BGP routes, there's a public BGP session required and also a private BGP session. We get a lot of questions about that. Why do you need a public and private session? There's resources in Azure that are only available publicly to the external internet. You might want to access these resources through Express Route as well. So mainly Express Route is for your virtual private cloud environment sitting in Azure. So it's a virtual network. You want to keep it private. You don't expose it to the public internet. That's where you use the private BGP session. There's some storage components and other services in Azure that won't have a private-facing interface. They are only available publicly. So those are the resources you access through the public BGP session. It's mandatory to set both of them up. If you're familiar a little bit with BGP, you might ask the question that, well, I know that I need to have an asynchronous or an autonomous service number, an ASN. The good news is for the public BGP session, you don't need to have a public ASN which you need to request and authorize from the internet authorities. You can use a private ASN as long as that ASN is higher than 65,000. So for both sessions, you can use a private ASN, which makes it easier to configure the BGP routing. From the bandwidth perspective, there's a choice. It's elastic. You can change it on a monthly basis. It ranges, as you can see, from 200 meg, 500 meg, 1 gig, and it goes up to 10 gigs. So it's really high bandwidth, high throughput that's available. The most use cases are the hybrid scenarios when you have on-premise components, DR into Azure, especially with the new InMarge acquisition. It makes it easier to put DR. And Stu talked about hybrid storage solutions with StorSimple, and there's a lot of other vendors working with Microsoft Azure providing these hybrid solutions. Yesterday, you saw Hitachi here. They were talking about their hybrid storage offering. NetApp and EMC also announced Azure hybrid burst storage offerings as well. They also leverage Express Chat for these scenarios. With that, I'll hand it back to Stu, and we'll wrap up the session with the Migration Accelerator.
Thanks, Stu. Thank you. So look, if you need to connect faster than what you can over the public internet, then Express Route's where it's at, and as it turns out, it all sits in Equinix. So the last bit I want to talk about is Migration Accelerator, and I want to talk about it really, really quickly because that's something that Microsoft only kind of announced a couple of weeks back. So what Migration Accelerator does is it's a tool that allows you to move virtual machines running various formats to Azure. And so at the moment it's a Windows-only feature, so it supports 2000R2 SP1 and above. And so what it does is it's got a bunch of tools around, hey, I can discover my workload, so here's what it is, and then I can replicate it to Azure, and then I can do a bunch of things like test that I can do a test cutover and go, well, is this going to keep working properly when I run it in Azure? So it lets me do all that replication and do things like if I've got a multi-tier app, I've got front-end, mid-tier, database tier, it allows me to actually say, well, I want to make sure that all those tiers are consistent before I cut my app over. So it's a way of moving things faster to Azure. This has come out of their InMarge acquisition. So it's a great Migration Accelerator is a great way to get stuff to Azure quickly. Like I say, it's in preview at the moment. I assume they'll be they will be moving pretty quickly with us, I think. And so as you can see, I can move a physical. I can now you do a P2V into Azure, I can do AWS move, I can do VMware, I can do Hyper-V. This will take care of doing all of that. It's just basically you sign up in Azure and then you download the tools from Azure and away you go. Great bit of functionality. There's not a lot of documentation out there about it yet, but so that's coming. So look, before we finish, look, there's kind of three things. Azure's a really, really big platform. So as IT pros, we've got a bunch of options around compute and network, but actually you can think beyond that. And there are a bunch of other services that you can leverage to make life easier and better for you. And look, the other thing is, you might not have picked this up, but you should probably learn PowerShell. Oh, and that's what the Fox says about Azure. So thank you very much. I'll kind of be around for the next 10 minutes or so. Thank you.